Welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast with your hosts, Richard Hill and Matthew Dalitz.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. My name is Matthew Dalitz, Editor-in-Chief of the Science of Psychotherapy, and I'm here with our Managing Editor, Richard Hill. Howdy, Richard.
Howdy, Matt. Fantastic to see you again. Here we are, another fantastically exciting week of chatting away, talking heads. Brilliant.
We do. We just keep on keeping on. Now, today, Richard, we are off to a few different places in Australia.
Oh, good. Yes. No, this is right. This week, we're looking at our Australian friends who have a conference coming up as well, which is really cool, a second conference. You've got the details there. Tell us about that. Who is it and what are they doing?
We're about to touch base with Dr. David Collins and Rita Princey Hubbard, who listeners will be familiar with, who we've had them on the show before, and they are doing their second Australasian Conference for Neuroscience, Learning and Wellbeing down in Melbourne, Australia.
And yes, it's great. It was on last year. They did really well. I mean, Dave's great with the brain growth stuff and all the working with schools, and Rita does all this fabulous. She's really pulled together. Mm. And she was, I think, this a lot of the same speakers who've developed their work over the last period of time. So it's just great to support people who are doing. What is really important is looking at our education. This is where we got to go. Number one thing, you know. Yeah, so it's fantastic.
Absolutely. And we know that there is a lot of interest in this topic of education and the psychology of education and what's happening with our kids, because we do get a lot of interest when this topic comes up. So, Richard, before we dive in, I thought we might give something away.
Well, yes, talking about educating people and getting educated, we've got a thing. We've got a very simple mechanism for learning about all kinds of good stuff, and that's the Science of Psychotherapy magazine, of which I am the managing editor, and I'm pretty proud of. So I don't know. We were talking. Maybe we should, just because people listen to our podcasts and it's a great thing, we should give a couple of subscriptions away. What do you reckon? You reckon that's okay?
That's okay. So what we will do is we'll put up a link in the show notes, and that will take you to a landing page, and you fill in some details there, and you'll be in the running to win one of two subscriptions to the magazine.
And fantastic.
We'll announce that next week, or we'll send an email out. How about that?
Yeah, we'll let them know. I mean, but that'll be great. It'd be great to have you on board, and you can get in and check us out. And remember, that's not just the magazine; that's all the history as well, all the archives.
So that's right.
It's a really good little subscription. And if you don't get it, jump on board as well. Well, I mean, we want more subscribers, of course. Mm. But this is just a great way of saying thank you for all the people that have been listening to our podcasts.
Okay, brilliant. Well, Richard, I'm in Brisbane, you're in Sydney, and let's together go to Adelaide and Melbourne.
Fantastic. an international show.
Okay, here we go. Dave and Rita, welcome to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. How are you both?
Very well, thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Matt. Thanks for having us, Richard.
Yeah, great to see you both. Fantastic.
Now, so we are, for those who don't know, Dave, you're coming from Melbourne and Rita from Adelaide, and there's been a lot of concern from around the world. Our listeners and our readers have been wondering about how we've been getting on over here in Oz. And so how are you guys doing in South Australia and Victoria?
Well, in South Australia, we've also had fires. Nowhere close to where I live, but we have a beautiful island over here in South Australia called Kangaroo Island.
Right,
Unfortunately, about a half or more of it has burnt, and so we've had some people lose their lives, definitely properties, and lots of wildlife that have unfortunately been lost. We're also even talking about the koala being very close to extinction levels on the island, and then the air quality is quite low. And I know, David, you've had very severe problems over there too.
Yeah. That Kangaroo Island is, it's been quite a sanctuary, hasn't it, for koalas, and there's been a massive loss there, which has been very sad.
Mm. Yeah, actually, yes, the pictures that you probably have seen, and we've seen them too, yes, definitely, really sad. So it's really affected, you know, personal loss, but also environmental loss, and then we've got these, you know, wonderful animals that, and livestock, and it's just been unprecedented, really. and the level of trauma and tragedy that is being experienced over here, but obviously over in New South Wales and Victoria.
Yes, I mean, it's interesting. There's lots of conversation, and still, so we don't want to get in the argument of climate change or not climate change. But I think what is sobering in this, and something that we need to pay attention to, is that this is what happens if a climate event, if an environmental event gets out of hand. Because we've had fires, and you know, for our friends in America, when we have fires every year, just like California, we have these wildfires. But we haven't had like 12 of them all at the same time. So it's the geographic spread of the fires, not the existence of the fires. And for those who are concerned about climate change, and I state that I'm one of them, is that these large environmental events are not controllable. Anyway, we won't do the argument of the politics, because it gets into politics there, which we don't want to do. But large environmental events, and of course, this is also related, and we'll talk about other things, but just quickly, just relating to what we're doing, is that one of the outcomes of this large environmental events is enormous impacts on mental health. And fortunately, our government is putting up, about $100 million for mental health rehabilitation as well. So I'm glad to see that we haven't, regardless of whether people say this is good or bad or shouldn't happen, that we're actually dealing with the humanity, and of course the animal welfare work is enormous as well. But David, you've got a lot of now Melbourne again. The urban areas are not too badly affected by the fires, but you've got this air quality issue, which is really damaging.
Yeah, absolutely, Richard. Look, I live very close to the city, within a couple of k's of the city, so the fires themselves don't really impact on us. But that's of little comfort. We were in the South Island, New Zealand, last week or the week before, in beautiful Queenstown, and the smoke from the fires was in Queenstown, and we woke up one morning with a blanket of smoke, 2,000 or 3,000 kilometres away, and we effectively had to spend the day, basically indoors. And the air quality at the moment, I think in Melbourne, behind Canberra, we're the second worst in the world. And walked out of the gym this morning, all I could smell was smoke. And it's a really significant issue. And as you mentioned, the wildlife, and seeing photos of dear friends of ours kind of sitting on the docks in Eden in southern New South Wales with their kids, with masks on and just a red background. It's very confronting. And I'm back at work this week in the clinic, and already I've had multiple conversations with young people who are my main client base about what's happening in our beautiful country, and a level of fear and apprehension about the future that they feel.
It's a tangible thing. We don't want to. Yeah. And I guess, Matt, can we segue from that very unsubtle point of human concern to what we've really got these gorgeous people in here? Because although we could talk about this for the whole session, I wonder if perhaps just for the sake of brevity, we need to move on. And so our concern's out, and we appreciate the concerns that we're getting from everybody around the world. I'm getting emails every day. It's really nice.
Yes, absolutely. So Rita, so do catch us up. What's been happening in your world, and what is coming up for you?
Okay, so in my world, definitely organising our next conference, our second international conference on neuroscience, learning and wellbeing. Lots of interest. Yep. So that's really great. This year we're extending it. We're going to include a parenting seminar as well as a one-day workshop. With my great colleagues, David Collins and Teddy Valise. So that's really exciting. In my world, I've actually just signed up. I'm now a PhD student with UQ. So,
how wonderful.
Yes, I'll be looking at the neuroscience variables in the relationship between teacher and student. So that's definitely my area. And I've been filming online modules, Brain Smart for Learning. So we finished filming all those over Christmas and now in the editing stage. And as you all know, and David knows with his program, that takes a little bit of time, but really keen to get that all going. To spread the word and have it available.
I'm very excited to hear you doing that, because actually I did a Masters of Education in 2010, something like that, And I did it on the neuroscience of positive and successful education programs, and I just used a lot of the documentaries and various things that were around that we already had, and the people said, "Oh, lovely thesis, this is very interesting, but we don't know who will mark it." Because the lack of knowledge. And I did have someone who came in and gave some comments, and they were interesting, but they weren't very knowledgeable. So this is what we need to do. We need to bring the knowledge of the system that we work in. You know, it's like someone saying, "I'm a mechanic, but I actually don't know anything about carburetors, and I don't really think I need to." And you sort of go, "Well, I think you do." So this is fabulous. So well done, putting it into that PhD research framework is brilliant.
Yeah, so that sounds like you've got a lot on your plate. So I don't envy how much of a workload you have. But do tell us a little bit more about the conference. Who are you targeting, and what sort of things will you be talking about in that conference?
Well, we're very privileged and honoured that all our presenters from last year actually asked if they could return. So very excited about that. I think, and David will obviously explain his view too, but I think it felt very much like a gathering of like-minded people, mainly educators, but also other professionals working with young people. Really, as I said, bringing this model that shows how to connect and engage rather than following that behavioural model. I found that, you know, people didn't want to leave. You know, we are finishing the conference and people still hanging around. So it's really, you know, bringing value to what's happening in education, but understanding the role of the educator. It's also really honouring the educator too. And that's how we start by saying we're here to do whatever we can to give you information that makes your job easier. So we talk about trauma and trauma-informed pedagogies, how to engage with young people. We have two schools that will be presenting, which is great. So Melbourne Good Grammar will have their coaches that will be presenting how they use neuroscience in their work with their students, but also Diamond Creek East Primary School, a very different area of Melbourne. And I think
Dad
can explain more about that. And their principal, Robert Rostolis, who will be opening our conference. I just felt he's the right guy because he actually implements it in his school. So we have people that work in the area doing research. We also have practitioners, but we have lots of educators who've also gone on and got PhDs in this area together with schools where it's actually being implemented.
Wow, so it sounds like quite a movement.
Now, Dave, we come to you, the Brain Grow work, all the fabulous stuff you do. Tell us what, because your contribution, we've had you on before on the program and I love the stuff you do. Tell us a bit more about what that and how that frames into a conference situation and how you're framing it into this primary school work. I'm guessing that's where you're doing stuff.
Yeah, absolutely, Richard. So, yeah, at the conference, I'll be doing a keynote and also, as Greg said, the one-day post-workshop, which is on that Wednesday, and a parenting night, which I'm really looking forward to. One of my favourite things to do is to go to schools and present to parents, which I do regularly here in Melbourne and also in other states. And really help parents to understand the role of the brain and development. And, you know, I think parents are a huge audience that need to continue to be educated on this. And there's just so many myths that continue to be perpetuated about development and the brain. And, you know, one of the ones I will certainly be talking about to the parents is in regards to adolescence and this idea that the teenagers are very impulsive and they never think about the consequences of their actions and these kind of things. But what we actually know is that generally isn't the case. And teenagers can actually be quite rational and quite reasonable. And there was one of the lovely little experiments that I like to talk about is an experiment where they get a bunch of teenagers to do a car simulator and their goal is to get from one side of town to the other as fast as they can, and they need to get through some traffic lights along the way, and they've got a choice of the traffic lights. They either stop and lose a guaranteed 10 seconds or they try to get through, but if they get through and catch the red light, then they lose 20 seconds. But if they get through without catching the red light, they lose nothing. And what they find is that teenagers, when they do this by themselves, they won't take a risk. So they'll stop, and they won't take the risk of losing the 10 seconds. Adults will do the same. But what they'll then find is that when they ask teenagers to bring their friends in and watch their get their peers to watch them, the teenagers will then take the risk and they'll try to get through, whereas the adults will actually stop at the red light and not take that risk. And ultimately what that's all about is for teenagers, their decision-making is profoundly influenced by social pressures. And that's one of the key kind of concepts that we'll be talking a lot about how social connection is such a key motivator for young people and how that relates to their friendships, but also how that relates to their relationships with teachers as well.
Yeah, fascinating. And what are some of the other, can you touch on maybe another myth? I've got teenagers, so I'm interested in these myths that we have about teens.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of them, aren't there? And, you know, one of the ones I talk about with educators is this concept of, you know, left brain versus right brain, and this child is more left brain and this child's more right brain. And, you know, I think that's a myth that probably gets back to, you know, the split brain, you know, experiments many decades ago. And, you know, I think for educators, you know, historically there have been kind of ideas that have been put together in maybe PDs in the 80s and the 90s, and they've kind of been quite sticky. What can kind of happen is kids can get quite pigeonholed under those circumstances. And what we obviously know now is the brain's all about integration and, you know, horizontal integration, for example, between those two areas. It was really interesting. A bit of research that came out just this morning, actually, looking at what predicts success in university, first year university, and they looked at year 12 mathematics. And what they found is that those who did well in year 12 mathematics generally did better in first year university. What was particularly interesting about that was it wasn't necessarily the type of mathematics they did. It was all types of mathematics in year 12, whether it be the easier mathematics or the more complex mathematics. And I think what's really interesting about that is in primary school, what we often see is girls losing confidence in about grade 3 and grade 4 in their mathematics ability, whereas boys tend to kind of build that. And it becomes self-fulfilling along the way. So this idea of how do we maintain that academic confidence, you know, what are some of the gender biases that come in as well in regards to that can be really important as well.
Right. So there's a lot of things in sort of the social construct rather than just innately in our brains, be boys versus girls or teens versus adults.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, like in anything in science, there's just so many different variables to break down, isn't there? And, you know, so many independent variables to analyze. But, you know, I think that it gets all the way back to kind of expectancy effects as well, and, you know, the Rosenthal study, and just helping teachers, I find that's really powerful, just helping teachers become aware of the power of their own expectations of the students in which they teach. Is just so fundamentally important. And, you know, I know Rita talks a lot about this, how expectations can inform attachment styles, and, you know, there's a whole range of different things there. And Lou Cozzolino talks about, you know, this idea of insecure attachment can lead to unteachable kids.
Otherwise
be very teachable.
Yeah. Well, it's all, I mean, it's what, I mean, we talk, as you know, Matt and I talk a lot about needing to think in more in systems, more in the interaction of things and the emergent qualities rather than the cause and effect. And you know, there are so many fascinating aspects that there you have a teenager who sits there driving a thing and he drives with a certain framework of thinking, but then you put in peer pressure or peer frameworks and suddenly it alters the way the brain functions. It alters the nature of the flow of energy and information through the brain, and out comes a different response, which is then you get stereotype threat and, you know, what I call the winner-loser world, and all these frameworks. Is it's not just as simple as you stick your kid in a school, they come out the other end and they have this particular quality and they get a job and they get married and then they have kids and they live happily ever after and they become like Matt and me. God help them. But yeah, so it's wonderful work. And Rita, Dave was just, you know, referring to some of the work you do in attachment and some of those things. Is that going to have a good space at the conference?
Absolutely. Last year, it was very honoured to be asked to write an article for you, and happy to keep doing that. that one of the articles that I did write was about children being the most misunderstood beings on the planet. I really believe that, because every time I work with schools or sometimes with parents who perhaps have got that old traditional way of looking at things, and I suppose in society can encourage that, really trying to explain what is going on, as you mentioned, Richard, too, getting to the core of what's happening, understanding, you know, really looking rather than behaviour modification, looking at behaviour as an expression of emotion, what's actually going on, and then linking it with the educator to say, well, teacher, what's going on for you? So this way it's a much more self-aware process. So, you know, always educator first, what's happening for you? Are you feeling stressed? Are your, you know, survival systems active? And how does that then influence the perception of the child's expression of emotion? But, you know, even in all the work, I know you've been working in the mirroring effect, really understanding what's happening there, what does get mirrored, or is the child then activating something for the educator? Mm-hmm. This is why there's a problem. So really getting to the core, what's going on, how to engage and connect, you know, how to really understand what's happening rather than, you know, and what's happening at home. What's happened at home with the attachment? Is that, you know, is that an insecure attachment? Has the child, unfortunately, you know, been just had a terrible morning because mum and dad have been yelling or at each other? Or, you know, there's a story that, you know, I heard where there was a child who was trying to learn to read, and there was a student teacher trying to help the child read, but the child kept putting their head down on the table. And then eventually the student teacher asked, well, what's happening? And this little student said, I'm sorry, she said, I haven't slept all night. Mum and dad have been yelling all night. So do you see how that could then be seen as not paying attention, or there's a learning difficulty, or, you know, and then unfortunately, you know, and I know, you know, diagnoses can be thrown around rather than perhaps really getting understanding what's happening for the child. And that's really where I come in. We think, oh, let's get enough information out there so we're all informed. For the benefit, really, ultimately, for the child, but also for helping empower the adult that's working with the child.
Yeah, yeah. As we talk about this, sorry, Richard, as we talk about this, it reminds me, I don't know if I've said this story, I probably have, so excuse me for repeating myself if you've already heard this story, but in high school, I remember, and Dave, talking about mathematics, halfway through high school, we had this very scary maths teacher. He was a cranky old bloke who would throw dusters at people that weren't paying attention and would yell at you and be now looking...
The good old days.
Now looking back, it was terribly abusive. And I was doing okay in maths up to that point. But that year really turned me off maths. And it wasn't, now I know, it wasn't my capacity to continue developing my mathematical skills. It was the teacher who was just a scary figure. And that just put a whole negative, you know, thing. And then, you know, we had better teachers later on. But I'd already fallen so far behind that, maths now wasn't in my repertoire of things that I was good at.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and I just, Dave's got something, and Rita's got, but just quickly to remind the listeners that if you remember, of course, jump onto the website, log in, of course. Remember, you've got to log in, or otherwise they don't know you're a member. And, you know, go back through the archives, check out, go back and find Rita's articles and Dave's articles and then various other. You can do it on subject matters. But the thing is, if you're not a member, go in and you're not really keen on doing that, you can still go in, find the magazine, and just for $4 or $5 you can buy the magazine and look at that particular article. So all these things are permanently accessible for people if they want to do it. That was all pitch, but it's important because the magazine's not just a popularity magazine, it's actually full of really great stuff. And now I've interrupted. Who wanted to go? Dave, you had some itching thoughts.
Yeah,
there.
No, not interrupting at all, which is it's a great point. And yeah, Matt, I think a lot of listeners will really identify with your experience there. And, you know, I certainly can identify with that too. And you know, I think the good news is it works the other way as well, in that you know, very often we just need that one hero teacher in our lives. And that can be profoundly protective for us. If we just have that one at some point in our school life, and that's a really important point to get across to teachers who have an incredibly stressful job. And you know, I think, as we may have mentioned in the last podcast, here in Victoria, the average life expectancy, you know, in terms of, you know, in the job is about 5 years for a graduate. So, you know, after 5 years, the average graduate would be expected to be out of education, which is, you know, a mind-boggling statistic.
Wow.
Given how profoundly important, you know, that role is. And
that's incredible. Is that in just in Australia, or is that sort of globally?
I think that's an Australian statistic, Matt.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And it's one that, it's interesting when I talk in schools, that's one that continues to get brought up, not necessarily by me, but by the teachers themselves. And, you know, I think educators are well aware of that. And I think that's part of Reed's wonderful conference is allowing the educators there to kind of share their experiences and the multiple pressures that they face, you know, not only from a, you know, schools are very data driven these days, which really can put pressure on teachers. And, you know, there's arguments to and for and against that, of course. But also, you know, parents have expectations as well. So teachers really face multiple pressures. And, you know, listening to Diamond Creek last year, Reed has talked about them a little bit in this podcast, and just seeing what happens when a school works as a whole was really powerful. And, you know, you could just see it in the way that they presented and some of the stuff that they showed.
That sounds like a smaller public school, is it? Diamond Creek?
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Yep, just to put it in perspective, yeah.
Interestingly, I was very fortunate to be invited to their biannual Brain Conference for year fives and sixes they have every year.
Oh.
Yeah,
it's wow.
Amazing. So I was invited in the huge auditorium, and they've got the table set up, and the children have lanyards with their names, and, you know, it's really very much set up as a conference. So the school and the psychologist that works with Maria Roberto put on this amazing conference for 2 days, really going right into the neuroscience principles, getting the kids to get up and pretend they're neurons and glial cells and all sorts of things, synapses. I was fortunate to be a guest speaker to answer their questions, which was definitely interesting. They were so informed, but it just shows, and the teachers have this ongoing education. And one of the things that Robert, the principal, mentioned was that other schools may say, but that'll take so much time. And he said, actually, it doesn't take any more time at all. You just blend it all into the school curriculum. And then some people might say, oh, you're focusing on wellness rather than performance. And as we all know, as David knows, what our whole conference is about, that's why we're so, I think, lucky to have the school come and present, is that it's not at the expense of performance. You actually increase performance because you have an integrated brain, the child feels connected, feels a sense of belonging, the educators feel the same way. So it's wonderful to see them present and just show how you do that in practical sense. And they're actually doing a workshop and a keynote, and they're bringing some students along. So, which I think will be great. So I think that's why we really want to have some hands-on things. Yes, it's really important to talk about the theory, but also what does it look like? How do you do it? And in our feedback at the end of last year's conference, that was something that was asked. So I'm really trying to listen to what the you know, attendees want and ensure that we're providing that. Hence why we've ended up with this one-day workshop.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Well, there's two things here that really stand out. One is incredibly positive and one is incredibly not positive. And one of the things I wanted to mention was the fact that what's really good is you're bringing the parents into this experience. And because I'm a great advocate for all this sort of stuff. One of the things in business is my little motto was make your workplace a life place. Well, make your school place a life place as well, and a family place, and a place which is terrific. So I'm really pleased with that. But the second one is what you were just saying there, is that somehow we have developed the social cognitive perception that social performance and human well-being are not directly related. They're not directly connected. Now, there's a couple of things there. As you're saying, wellness obviously improves performance, but there is an incredible unnaturalness about our attitudes towards education. And there's so many examples that you and I, we could all cite, of when you actually stop this sort of robotic, almost motoristic, demanding education system, and you make it a human system, that people learn three times as quickly and so on and so forth. And so I just want to point out those two things. But particularly the engagement of the parents making the school experience a social experience.
Absolutely. And they do it at the school, definitely. They invite parents there too. But that's why, yes, as David was saying, so critical to involve the parents, to also let them know that they are important and that we need to be able to share the information so everyone's on the same page, I suppose. But also explaining to parents that if they're having a bad day or things aren't going well for them, that that will impact on the child. But, you know, always adult need to care for adult self, and then obviously that transfers in how they engage the child, which is so beneficial.
Do the parents come as delegates to the conference as well?
They're welcome to, if they'd like to come to the conference as well. We've got early bird rates still happening. We've also got discounted rates if parents want to come together as a group. So,
cool.
Which is a great idea.
Great incentive, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. So David and Teddy and I talked about it and said we'd like to have more of them. So, you know, if we can do that and give them a great rate. So, yes, absolutely. So it gives everyone a chance to really listen to what we have to say. And hopefully that helps in everything that they're doing with children.
Because that's what you do, Dave. You actually include the parents in the experience quite a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in BrainGrow, parents are a big part of it with our parent videos. And I've just got back from New Zealand filming a whole bunch of them from the top of a mountain and the side of a lake and doing some really fun videos over there, which I'm busy editing at the moment, which I can't wait to release to our BrainGrow schools as well. And, you know, thinking about that point that we're making about, you know, well-being and performance, Rita and I were talking the other day about the later years of high school and where that becomes really, really important, and, you know, the final year and, you know, however we measure that, whether it be an ATAR here in Victoria or SATs in the States or whatever it might be. And I think what can happen is that kind of well-being and performance can become quite a bit muddled with the pressure that comes on kids as they finish up their high school years. And you know, one of the things that I often see is that kids will set themselves, what we call, you know, year 12 kids here in Victoria, in their final year of high school, will set themselves a score that they need to get. You know, and it's out of 100. You know, I need to get an 80 or a 90 or a 70 or a 60, whatever that might be. And I've even had kids kind of put that above their bed so they kind of see it when they go to bed at nighttime. And, you know, we kind of talk about the pressure that kind of creates. And, you know, this idea, well, what happens if you get 20% less on your first assignment? What does that mean? And how does that then impact on your motivation going forward? And how we need to educate parents that, you know, the score isn't everything. And what I always encourage these year 12 kids to focus on instead is behaviors, things that they can control, as opposed to the score at the end, which they clearly can't. And, you know, when are they going to take breaks? What day over the weekend are they going to have off and do no study at all? You know, how many questions in class are they going to ask, and these kind of things. And I find that's a really great paradigm shift for kids when they start thinking, all right, well, there's behaviors that I can control, which will help to improve my outcome, but I don't have to set myself a specific score because I can't actually control what that score is entirely.
Mm. Yeah, and this score that they're aiming for is it's a narrow band of cognitive abilities that they're being scored on, isn't it? I mean, I've got a 21-year-old who, you know, he's struggled in his last year or last few years academically, but he's brilliant in artistic things, and he's, you know, none of that was, you know, really part of his assessment in school. So the score that they're aiming for is a narrow band of cognitive ability. So how do we address that with kids? Because it's not that score isn't the whole of who they are as a being.
This is a really passionate topic of mine, Matt, and, you know, I couldn't agree more with what you said. And, you know, it's the system we've got, and it's the best we've got at the moment. But as you said, you know, it can be quite a narrow band. And, you know, when you sit down with teenagers, you know, at that level of their schooling, I think they all agree with that idea. None of them particularly like it, but, you know, it's just the system we've got. Right. Helping them realize that, you know, they are so much more than that number is so important. The number's important. I'm not for a minute trying to kind of say it's not important. for some kids, you know, trying to get into different courses and that kind of thing. But helping kids to realize it's not everything actually improves their performance anyway throughout year 12. So, you know, it's this kind of paradoxical effect that occurs. And, you know, I can almost set my watch by every August. I'll get kind of, you know, 10, 20 phone calls from really, really kind of concerned parents or schools about, you know, year 12 kids who've kind of hit the wall because of all the pressure that they're putting on themselves. And if we can start that early, we can kind of educate parents, you know, in primary school in those early years about the importance of focusing on other factors that readers talk about, social connection and attachment and enjoyment and fun and these kind of things that really do make a difference in learning, then that pays off later on in not just school life, but life in general.
It's interesting. My daughter actually chose not to go for the marks. She went for the subject she wanted to study. She's got a bit of talent. There's a bit of background in writing. She went into journalism, and she's now in her mid-30s. And so we have to get a larger piano to take the 5 Walkleys that she's won. And she's just published her first book, which has been an Australian bestseller. It's about to be released in America and the UK. And it came through passion, curiosity, hard work, and an intention. So I think the intention of the score is a great idea, but as a mechanism and as a pathway to something rather than as a measure and a mark of your worth and value.
It's not predictive, is it? I mean, future success in so many different areas.
And there is some reflection out where schools are. I think I was at a conference last year, which was in Melbourne, which was run by Melbourne Girls Grammar School, and it was really learning in the digital age. So talking a little bit more about more project-based learning and eventually maybe not needing a score, so that even in school the learning is really about taking a project, and then you may need maths in that project and English and other topics to do that, and then perhaps transferring that more over to university. I think it's in early stages, but then sort of looking at the benefits and maybe not the benefits of doing that type of learning. So I suppose we're in a stage of change, especially with artificial intelligence coming into play. But that conference was quite interesting, and I know that school's trying very much to look at it more as a project-based learning. I know in the US it's happening as well, and in some of their universities. So I suppose there's that time of transition, so we'll see what happens. But I agree with all of you. I think, yeah, it's really working on well-being. And there's so many pathways anyway. I find that, you know, I know that going in that final year of secondary school is one way to get into further study, but also that there are other ways, and that perhaps, as you've both mentioned with your children, it doesn't always have to be that traditional way, because if they've got different skills, well, wonderful. And you know, using that passion and motivation can lead to so many wonderful paths in the future.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking the interviews with people in their later ages of, you know, what did they value in their lives. Education was absolutely one of the high ones, but pretty much predominantly the top one is my health. And if we could actually just get beyond health and actually my well-being. I had a life of well-being and I was educated. I think it is a good combination.
Absolutely.
Okay. Absolutely.
Wonderful. Sarita, let us know the dates and where this wonderful conference of yours is going to be.
Thank you. Our date for the 30 and 31st of March, that's the two-day conference. Then we have a parenting seminar on the evening of the 31st of March, which is about between 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. and then on Wednesday we'll have the post-conference workshop, which is the 1st of April. It'll be in Melbourne, it'll be in East Melbourne at the Catholic Leadership Centre, and the reason we chose that venue is because it has accommodation on site. We have all the, you know, the facilities in there for lunch and afternoon, morning tea, great venue for our presentations. And we do have a social event on the Monday evening inviting all our attendees and whoever wants to come just to have a drink and a nibble and discuss further. So,
okay.
Page of everyone.
Wonderful. And will there be any recordings of any sessions for people that can't make the conference?
Well, that's something we need to negotiate with each of the presenters. So some presenters are happy to do that. We did have a couple that did that. Others not so. Some are happy to give their slides, some not so. So it'll be individually really negotiated with each presenter.
Okay, wonderful. Well, we'll point everyone to the website and give them that in the show notes. Before we leave you guys, any final thoughts that you'd like to leave us with about this wonderful topic of education?
Well, I think, Matt, you know, in picking up on what Rita said, you know, the conference really is a celebration of young people and the wonderful adults in their lives and the profound influence that those adults can have, you know, whether it be their teachers, their principal, their vice principal, their parents, their speech pathologist who works with them every second Wednesday, whatever it might be, and just recognizing how, you know, a positive and enriched environment within a school is very possible and the profound effects that can have not only on their learning but their lifelong well-being. And that's something that you know, gets me into my clinic every day, you know, that concept. And, you know, I know Rita is, and Teddy and all the other wonderful presenters are, you know, very much on the same vein.
Wonderful, wonderful. Rita?
Well, I think, again, yes, knowing that it's not so much that this conference is about letting, sort of telling educators what to do. It's really coming from a place of saying we want to work with you and support you and use the knowledge we have so that we are working together, because I think we're all critical people in children's lives. And as you've said, David, it is a celebration of young people. So, you know, they are our most important asset, and we need to ensure that we're doing everything we can as adults, not only hopefully to leave the planet in a better state, but also to give them those tools and understanding so they can go forth and be the best that they can be in every way.
Yeah. Well, Rita and Dave, thank you so much for being in this space and doing the valuable work that you do. And, looking forward to so much more of it and looking forward to more conversations here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks, Richard.
Yeah. See you guys later.
See you then. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, again, another great chat. I just loved hearing all that stuff about parents, including parents in the educational process and the educational experience. So I'm really glad they're having those additions to the workshop. So good on them, and good luck to them, and everybody go.
Yeah, wonderful. So we also have Teddy Valise, who's also one of our experts here at the Science of Psychotherapy, and he'll be speaking at this conference. We didn't get a chance to catch up with him, but we'll catch up with him separately.
Oh, that'll be good. I like Teddy. He's great.
Yeah, and we'll get his a bit of a download from him about what he's presenting. So this is going to be the second Australasian Conference for Neuroscience, Learning and Wellbeing. And go to the show notes and we'll have a link there for that. Now, Richard, giving away the magazine.
Yes, remind you all, two subscriptions to the magazine and all the archives. All you have to do is follow the links and we'll make that available. That'd be fantastic.
Okay. Wonderful. Thanks, Richard. Thanks, everybody, for joining us here on the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. We'll catch you next week.
Bye for now. Thanks for listening to the Science of Psychotherapy podcast. For more great science, go to thescienceofpsychotherapy.com.